Oh boy. Good evening. Good evening, everyone. My name's Lee. Well, it's a privilege to be here today. Boy, there are a lot of you. All right, I want to welcome our newcomers, Lori, David, and Michael. Welcome. Well, I can only imagine what you expected when you walked into this meeting today. It brings us all back to our first meeting. Mine was in Berkeley, California in 1992. And, it was the last place I wanted to be. I was feeling desperate, not only over my father's drinking, but about life in general. My life, I felt was out of control. I felt like I was broken, and yet I was so resistant to get help. If I had another solution that I thought could have worked for me, I wouldn't have gone to that meeting. And I remember going into that meeting feeling that way. And my lasting memory from that meeting was that people shared a lot of embarrassing things. And that might have been my perception, if only because I didn't grow up in an environment in which people shared honestly. And that's what it felt like. And so, hopefully, for Lori, David, and Michael, despite how you're feeling today, if you keep coming back, this will be a special day for you, just like it is for the many people who took a cake here today. And that, hopefully, what you will remember from today is not the despair and confusion that you might be feeling now, but over time, a sense of gratitude for what this program, this fellowship, and people that you meet here will contribute to your life. Because that is my sense when I think back to my first meeting. My path to my first meeting goes back, I suppose. It can begin with my parents, who were both born in China. And then they went to Taiwan, and they managed to both study at a university in Knoxville, Tennessee. And that's where they met. And even then, my mother says she was aware of my father's drinking because there was beer cans all over his car. We would move from Tennessee to New York and then settle down in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And there was Milwaukee, Wisconsin back then in the 70s was a great place to live. We moved to a suburb where all the backyards were interconnected. You can play until dark. It was very carefree. And in many ways, I enjoyed a very privileged childhood. But even back then, there were signs of this family disease working in our home. There was violence in our home. And I can even remember violence even before we moved to Wisconsin. But perhaps from my childhood, more than memories of my father drinking, I have sharp memories of those evenings or those incidents in which my parents fought. And I was the only child, and so they would sometimes shuffle me into a room. And I couldn't see what was going on, but I could certainly hear what was going on. I would see what was going on the next morning when I walked out and found the broken dishes. And so those memories, those memories stay with me. And today, you know, when my mother comes to visit from San Francisco, you know, for years, this would always happen. She would come down and days before her visit, I would get very, very stressed out. I'd want to do everything perfectly, and I never knew why. And then just this past visit, a couple weeks ago, I think I got some idea of why. And that is that there's a real part of me that feels responsible for my mother. Back then I felt responsible for trying to protect my mother. And there's still a part of me that feels responsible for my mother. But we would, but you know, I largely, like I said, had a happy childhood, but for those incidents. But alcoholism, as we learned, is a progressive disease. And we would move to California, to the Bay Area, and my father's drinking would continue. And but not only that, but as his drinking continued, the family eventually began to deteriorate. And we would all live in the same house. And in fact, they both did fairly well for themselves. They worked hard in the computer industry. And they bought a nice home up in the Bay Area. But the drinking and the violence still would continue. The police were called over to the house. And, you know, I remember being, well, if not just focused, obsessed about my father's drinking. Now, I didn't really consciously think about it. For many years, I didn't talk to my father about it. We never talked about my father's drinking in the family. But, you know, typically he would wake up and then he would get up late at night and pour himself a drink. And he would go out his bedroom door, turn on the light, and as soon as he did that, I would wake up. And I could hear, you know, his routine. He would go downstairs, open the, you know, freezer, put some ice in a glass, and pour himself a drink. And so there was a part of me that was very focused on his drinking. And I remember once bringing it up with my mother, and I was in college. I was in college then, and I said, and I brought up my father's drinking, and my mother's response was, "Well, don't worry about it. You just study hard in school, okay? God bless you." All right, but that was how I was raised, okay. Nothing short of an A was okay, and if you got good grades in school, then you can get a good job. And if you get a good job, then you'd be happy. Okay. Looking back now, that was a form of our denial. Okay, so we wouldn't have to talk about my father's drinking. One time I came back from, when I said that our family started to deteriorate, my father eventually lost his job at the university where he was a computer administrator. My mother started to have back problems, and she went out on disability. And then I started having tension headaches. And it was very confusing then because I didn't know what was happening. But I did know that I had a lot of difficulty concentrating, so I couldn't sit down and read a page. I would spend a lot of time in my room crying inexplicably. And I felt very depressed. And so my mother attributed this to a bicycle accident that I had. And so we went to a doctor and I got MRIs. And I remember sitting in the urologist's office with my parents, and the urologist told us that the results of the MRI or the CAT scan, whatever the case may be, were normal. And then he referred me to a counselor. And so I went to counseling before I found Al-Anon. And many people do. And it was a good start for me because it was the first time that I felt that I could confide in someone and someone was really on my side. Now, of course, my parents were, okay, but I always felt the need to meet their expectations. And I think that's what, for me, even without alcohol, almost killed me, is trying to meet their expectations. Now, I could have studied in school 24 hours a day and thought nothing of it, but I was very, very unhappy. So my father would continue to drink, and one day a good friend of mine was over to our house, and he saw a bunch of recycled bottles, empty bottles, in the recycling bin, and he said, "Hey, what's going on here?" I said, "Well, you know, my dad just, you know, my parents just had a party." But the truth is that those are my father's bottles that he drank and that was outside that he consumed. But that was the first pinprick in my consciousness that maybe my father had a drinking problem. So I would come home for spring break one time and went out to dinner with my father and a friend of his, and he consumed an entire bottle of wine. And the next day, I remember waking up thinking, you know, I don't know that there's anything more that I can do about my father's drinking. Not that I did a whole lot, but that I was just, you know, I was on some level preoccupied with it. So I went to the AA Central office near where we live, and I went to a hospital, and I got him some literature. I went home, and I told him that I was concerned about his drinking, and, you know, here are some options for you. And you know, it didn't take right away. But I was. But somehow, and I can't remember exactly how, I found out about Al-Anon, and I went to that first meeting. And you know, those first meetings, you know, I felt feelings, whole range of feelings for the first time, because we didn't talk about feelings in my family. And so part of what Al-Anon did for me when I was new was to give me a vocabulary about how I felt. You know, frustration, disappointment, anger, etc. Okay. And as soon as I would leave those meetings, those early days, I would cry. I would find some place and just cry because you know, I didn't allow myself to feel those feelings until I got into the rooms of Al-Anon. You know, eventually, my father would find Alcoholics Anonymous. And I remember the day in which he said, "Lee, take me to a meeting." And then he left the house. Now, by that time, my parents had been separated. Now, they were separated, but they were living in the same house. They were just living on opposite ends of the house. And so, what I remember then is feeling feeling joy, because my father was willing to avail himself the same steps that I had been learning and that had already been working in my life. And I felt pain of some of those years of living in the family disease come to the surface. Now, you know, I was never arrested. I didn't drive my car off a cliff. And as far as I know, my father didn't either. You know, we lived, outwardly, a very privileged life. But all the money in the world could not have stopped my father from drinking. And so that experience has really shaped my views on money and the power that it holds. But we went to that first meeting, and as I've said, I think my father slept right through it. I thought it was a great meeting, and it was at the hospital that I got some literature for him from. And both of us would be in recovery. I remember him having his sponsor over, inviting him over. Apparently, he was doing his fourth step, and he made frozen pizza for him. And we would, I'd go visit him. By this time, I was in Los Angeles. I would go up to the Bay Area to visit him, and we'd go to these alcathons during the holidays, which is coming up. These are round-the-clock meetings that they have, at least up there, 24-hour AA meetings. Spent one Thanksgiving up there. And I remember one Christmas I would visit. I was feeling apprehensive about it, so I called my sponsor, Willie, and he said, just be of service. And we spent a beautiful day up in the Bay Area, riding the buses around, etc. And not long after that, I went to visit again, and I saw that he had gone out because there was alcohol throughout the house. And not long after that, I got a call from my mother saying that that my father had passed away. She found him on the floor. And that was the first time that I experienced grief in my life. And the people in this program and at this meeting Thursday night, walked me through that. They passed around a card, and that card I kept by the side of my bed. It was the first thing that I saw in the morning. And I felt so many different things. I felt resentful towards my father for what had happened, but yet I also felt relief that we didn't have active alcoholism in our house, in our home anymore, and that my mother was spared the decision whether or not to divorce my father. I felt guilt because I couldn't save my father from drinking. I would think to myself, what if I had called my dad on that day he took the last drink? Maybe he wouldn't have taken it. And so what I needed to do, and what I did, was to go back to the steps, in particular the first step. And I love that 12 and 12 that we have, the original one. And it's one that I got at my very first meeting. And I went back to that book, and I talked about the feelings of release that we feel from our negative emotions, guilt and fear, resentment, when we let go. And it was going back to those steps, and particularly the first, that got lasting relief from what I was feeling. And I couldn't say that I was grateful, for my father at that time. I couldn't say that I could only think of the good things at that time. It took me a while. But meanwhile, I started a life down here in Los Angeles, and I attended my first meeting here in 1993. And my first meeting, I met my sponsor, and he patted me on the butt, asked me if I was new. And I gotta say, he loves us in a very special way. But it's true. It's true, Willie. And that's so I'm glad to see him here today, and his lovely wife, Patty. You see some real stalwarts in our meeting here who are always in line on birthday nights, even if they're not taking a cake, because we're giving cakes. Okay. Willie, Jack, so many others. And that's what helps, I think, keep the stability of this meeting, the attendance, because people need to see their sponsors, okay? And so we have a regular group of men here, as well as newcomers, that keeps this meeting thriving and alive. And Willie is about the same age as my father, there's no doubt in my mind that he is like a father figure to me, just as so many men are to so many of the people that they sponsor. And these rooms save lives. We don't save lives as individuals. God doesn't bless us with that power. But the program has that power if we are willing to work at it. I can't tell you. I don't know that anything I can tell you can convey to you the certainty that I feel that I would not have the life I have today, but for the men and for the men in these rooms, the men and women in these rooms, and this program. We, as our literature says, we come to this meeting to learn the secret of compelling someone to stop drinking. Okay. Well, we find a different secret in these rooms. One that dispels the confusion and the despair, and that brings us hope. So, for Lori, David, and Michael, if you didn't expect to see a room of smiling faces and laughter, then just know that there are more than likely people in this room who are facing as difficult of a situation or a more difficult situation than you are, but that they are managing to live despite of those circumstances, to live once again. And that's the hope that we find in these rooms, that there are those of us who are living or have gone through exactly what you were feeling now, but we are able to find a life and find contentment notwithstanding that. So I would continue to work the steps, and I work the fourth step with the four column method in our in the AA Big Book. And so I found that for me personally to be the most effective. And the reason why I say that is because it forced me to write down my resentments, and then what my part in the resentment was. And so many times I have found that if I'm resentful, it's because I take things personally. Okay. And so when I do my fourth and tenth steps, when I, more often than not, when I feel a resentment and I write it down, that's the culprit. I take offense at what someone has said and I take it personally. And something magical happens when I go through that process and I write it down. The resentment disappears. Many times for me, the source of my resentment is wanting to be right. Even if it means nurturing grievances, seeing myself as a victim, and wallowing in self-pity. Right? So I've written that phrase down countless times. Okay? And the resentment goes away. Now, I have always had difficulty with criticism. Okay? And maybe my desire to do things perfectly is a defense against that, because I feel that if I do things perfectly, then I won't be criticized for what I do. Okay. But then if I look a little deeper than that, I find that the source of my difficulties is that I'm looking for other people's approval. And if I weren't looking for your approval, then I wouldn't care about your criticism. Okay? But it's because, you know, I seek, because the approval of others has been important, then I react when I'm criticized. And that has been a great lesson for me. And now, I'm going to transition, having said that, I'm going to transition to talk about my wife. Now we have two kids today. Let me just say this. We have two kids today. And the reason why it's fresh on my mind is because I've had a very busy month. Right? And I haven't been home very much. She hasn't been happy about it. But today I can tell her that I love her, even if she's angry with me. And I can see how much she does for me and my family, and be grateful for it. And know that without her, my life today would not be possible for me to do the things for me to have the kind of commitments that I do. Okay, and you know, the very first time I met her, okay, she was complaining about something. I can't remember what it was. Right? And she comes from a very different family than I do, right? Because my family, right? Only child. We don't talk about feelings, right? We don't really criticize each other, but not in her family, okay? Her and her siblings speak their mind. And I remember one time, I was up in Northern California, and she was down in Southern California, and she said something like, "All men are pigs." and the next thing I know, I borrow my mother's car, and I drive down to Los Angeles. I show up on her doorstep, and much to her surprise, because I want to fix things, right? Because I feel so uncomfortable about what she said. I have to make it right. All right. But, you know, she's a beautiful woman. She's a lovely woman. I've learned so much from her. Okay. And, but one example that I don't take for granted is learning how to deal with criticism. Okay. And that has been a great gift to me. And I struggled with it. When we were dating early on, I didn't know how to sit with those feelings. I love this person, but yet I felt trapped, right? And so our literature suggests that we have options, right? We can say the serenity prayer, we can change the subject, we can make a phone call, we can leave the room, we can take a walk, okay? And if we feel resentful, we can write it down. But we have options, and we're not trapped. We would eventually get married. And you know, some of you were, you know, in this room were here. And you know, I had to make an adjustment when I was, you know, when I was married. Because when I was single, even though we were dating, I attended a lot of meetings, and I was active in service. But you know, after we got married, you know, I had to find a balance between being there for my spouse and my program. And later, 7 years afterwards, I had to find another balance when we had kids. Now, I think I would have been perfectly happy not having kids. But eventually I found that, you know, after being in this program a certain number of years, I finally had something to contribute to the next generation. And you know, if my kids were here, they just, they're 10 and 8 now, they'd probably shake their heads, and because, I try to pass on some of our, you know, Al-Anon ideas, and they just rather just put their hands in their ears. But I did. But after we had kids, I had to find a new balance. And so, you know, these days, you know, if I get to more than one meeting a week, you know, I consider myself lucky. Now, I don't recommend it for everyone, okay? But it's what I need to do for myself. Because my greatest fear in becoming a parent was being an absentee parent, not being there for my kids. And so, you know, my sponsor, you know, tells me that I'm doing the right thing. And you know, these days, you know, I just have nothing but gratitude. I'm trying some new things out these days. I turned 50 a couple months ago, and so I decided that I was going to make a commitment to meditation. And boy, I'll tell you, you know, why didn't I do this early? Really, it's, you know, so in the morning, you know, I set aside 10 minutes, and all I do is I say the serenity prayer a couple of times, and then I breathe in and out, counting with my breaths in and out to 8, and then I start over, 1 through 8. For about 10 minutes, and it's really had a noticeable effect on my life. I think I'm calmer. I have better concentration. I can focus more because I think what it helps me do is for that 10 minutes, I don't think about anything else. And even though I'm anxious to get started on my day, I have a list of things that I'd like to get done. For that 10 minutes, I managed to push it out of my mind. And that pays dividends throughout the day in not being distracted and being able to concentrate and to focus. All right. So something you might consider. Okay. And those tension headaches eventually went away. Okay. Another benefit of this program that I never counted on, or I never imagined I would have received when I first walked into these rooms. All right. So now I look back at those tension headaches, and to me, they are a symptom of this family disease. Okay. I wanted so hard to please my parents, but yet I was so unhappy doing so. And so, college kid, I got involved in activities, and it was just all too much for me. And so I started suffering from those tension headaches. But they're gone now. And today, this program teaches me a life of balance. It teaches me to set priorities. Okay. And I was just in the car, with my oldest son yesterday, talking about first things first, and setting priorities. And he was probably shaking his head, but what a blessing. And I could not ask for more from a family. My wife and kids, these are more than anyone could ask for in my life. And so I'm grateful. I'm grateful for my parents. I'm grateful for the work ethic that they instilled. I'm grateful for those tension headaches because they forced me to drop out of school and to take a break for a while and then to come back. Okay. I'm grateful for these rooms, for my sponsor, for the men, in my Thursday night meeting. And, today, there's still some unfinished business. When I read my ninth step to my mother years ago, I read it to her, but there was no emotion there. And these days, when we're on the phone, it's hard for me to tell her how grateful I am for her. How grateful I am for everything that she's done. That there's no words that can express. There's no way that I can thank her for the many things that she's done for me. And the problem is now is that I haven't told her that. And maybe there's a part of me that still wants someone to blame. I don't know. I hope that's not the case. But she's happier now than she has been in a while. She has a companion now, but she still feels the effects of this family disease. Not too long ago, she was visiting. We had a quiet moment, and for some reason, she started to talk about the times when she fought with my dad and how painful it was for her following those physical arguments. And I could see and hear the pain and the bitterness and the anger that she still lives with. And thank God I didn't have to live with that type of abuse. But if it weren't for this program, I'd be in the same space. And so today, I remind myself that I have a responsibility to practice Tradition 5, which encourages us to practice the 12 steps by ourselves, to encourage and understand our alcoholic relatives, and to welcome and give comfort to families of alcoholics. And my mother qualifies as a family member of an alcoholic, even though she's not in this program. And perhaps, you know, the only thing I can do these days that's of any significance in her life is to tell her that I love her and to provide some measure of comfort to her. Even if I just say, I know, Mom, it's going to be okay. And that second part of our tradition too should not be overlooked. Tradition 5, to understand and give encouragement to our alcoholic relatives. Even though we're resentful at them, we're angry at them, to understand and give encouragement. Because we may be the only people who are willing to do so. So I'm so grateful for this program. If you're new, please come back. Please keep coming back. You know, if I could tell my mother I've read this too in the forum just the other day. You know, this person told their mother if they had a new mother, okay, it would be just like the one they had. And if I had to live this life all over again, okay, regardless of all the pain that I felt, which year by year lessens, and year by year the price of admission to this program becomes less and less, but certainly if I had to do it all over again, knowing that I'd find Al-Anon, okay, there's no question but that I would. So thank you so much for spending your evening with me. Thank you, David, for asking me. And thank you for letting me share.